Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael McPherson, Interim Executive Director with Veterans for Peace, who discusses his view that a new American-led war in Iraq and Syria will only inflame violence in a region already racked by ethnic conflict. Lee Stewart, a young climate activist from Virginia, who explains why he's participating in the 8-month-long coast-to-coast Great March for Climate Action. And environmentalist Jay O'Hara, who along with Ken Ward blocked a 40,000-ton shipment of coal at the Brayton Point Power Plant in Massachusetts, talks about why he risked arrest to confront a major source of climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since the day Mexican federal police officer Luis Angel Leon Rodriguez disappeared in 2009, his mother has worked every day without success to find out what happened to him. Rodriguez's inability to get credible information about her son is a common experience for the families of thousands of those who disappeared during Mexico's drug war. The number of Mexicans killed and disappeared surged in 2006 after then-President Felipe Calderón militarized the police to battle drug traffickers. Over the next 6 years of the drug war, it is estimated that more than 60,000 Mexicans have been killed and over 26,000 disappeared. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the number of disappeared in Mexico is on the same scale as under Argentina's military dictatorship during the 1970s and 80s and during Colombia's decades-long civil war. However, human rights groups charge that these numbers are being intentionally underestimated to cast the Mexican government in a better light. Officials counter that lower numbers are the result of decreasing crime and violence nationally. New laws protecting victims' rights have required the federal government to establish a transparent national registry of those who have disappeared, using the existing databases as a starting point. But progress has been slow. National tragedy and a faltering economy have given Marina Silva, the candidate of the Brazilian Socialist Party, momentum against incumbent President Dilma Rousseff going into the October 5th presidential election. Silva won the third highest vote total in 2010 as the Green Party presidential candidate. This year, she ran for vice president with Socialist Party presidential candidate Eduardo Campo until Campo was killed in a plane crash in August. Now, Silva, who has replaced Campo as the party's standard-bearer, has surged into second place by leveraging her fame as environmental minister under former President Lula da Silva and talking about her roots growing up in a poor community of rubber tappers in the Amazon region. Silva, who is calling for sweeping political change, has endorsed social programs like La Bolsa Familia, a program engineered by the ruling leftist Workers' Party that reduced the nation's level of extreme poverty. She also highlights her evangelical Christian faith. Francisco Fonseca of the Getulio Vargas Foundation in Sao Paulo told the Los Angeles Times that Marina Silva entered the race attacking the political system itself, even though she has been a part of it, and that has led to her quick rise in the polls by directly appealing to young voters. Silva also tapped into growing dissent in Brazil, seen in mass protests leading up to the recent World Cup games, where citizens demanded public investment in quality public education, healthcare, and transportation. Greater New Orleans law enforcement has gained a nasty reputation among immigrant rights advocates for its aggressive tactics. The Obama administration's Criminal Alien Removal Initiative in southern Louisiana has a high level of coordination between ICE agents and local police departments, employing heavy use of high-tech fingerprinting devices to randomly screen the city's many Latino residents. The New Orleans Workers' Center for Racial Justice has collected dozens of complaints about police raids of Latino neighborhoods and vehicle checkpoints with local police fingerprinting drivers. According to The Nation magazine, 3/4 of Latinos fingerprinted in these operations were released since they were in the U.S. legally. Last November, immigrant workers blocked traffic near the New Orleans ICE office, protesting the raids. In response, New Orleans Congressman Cedric Richmond wrote a scathing letter to ICE's acting director, complaining that the tactics used in the Big Easy violated government policy and amounted to racial profiling. A few months later, the New Orleans ICE director was transferred to a new job in Washington, D.C., and the aggressive raids targeting the Latino community have decreased. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Obama's speech to the nation on September 10th laid out his plan to escalate U.S. military intervention in a new war to degrade and eventually destroy the Islamic State, or ISIS, which has taken control over large swaths of territory in both Syria and northern Iraq. The president stated that while his new campaign against ISIS will not include the deployment of U.S. ground forces into the conflict, it will enlist an international coalition to support Iraqi soldiers and perhaps troops from other allied nations. Mr. Obama said U.S. airstrikes that had already been targeting ISIS militants in Iraq will be expanded to include targets inside Syria. While most public opinion polls find that voters view ISIS as a major threat and support expanded U.S. military action to confront the radical Sunni group, Americans still strongly oppose sending U.S. ground troops into a new war. But in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee on September 16th, General Martin E. Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that he would recommend deploying U.S. combat forces into the campaign against ISIS if the current strategy of airstrikes failed. After a September 15th summit meeting in Paris, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that more than two dozen nations pledged unspecified support for the campaign to stop the advance of the Islamic State, which the CIA estimates has between 20 and 31,000 fighters in Iraq and Syria. Your reporter spoke with Michael McPherson, interim executive director with Veterans for Peace, a group which opposes a new war in Iraq and advocates a six-point plan that calls for diplomacy to be the number one priority and to include Iran as a partner to help pressure the Iraqi government to be more inclusive of Sunni leaders. Here, McPherson, an Army veteran of the 1990-91 Desert Shield campaign in Iraq, discusses his view that a new American-led war in Iraq and Syria will only inflame violence in a region already wracked by ethnic conflict.
Generally, we're disappointed, but not surprised. We're disappointed because the U.S. will continue to be the greatest purveyor of violence on the earth, as Dr. King said in 1967. It will be the continuation of a failed policy of war-making in the Middle East. It's basically a gamble that this war policy will work this time. It continues to waste financial resources, which could be directed towards human needs and support our economy that really needs help. And it for sure means that regardless of what they're saying, that service members can be killed or probably will be because they can be shot down. And certainly innocent Iraqis, innocent Syrians, and disproportionately, women and children will be impacted and killed by war. These things are pretty much guaranteed. So we're basically continuing the same policy that we've had for 13 years, but supposedly without boots on the ground, which we know that close to 2,000 people are actually in Iraq that we know about. And then there's certainly other forces that are there and in Syria, too, more than likely, because if I were in charge and if I were playing this game, I would do that. And we're not surprised simply because it never seems like any of our political leaders are looking for solutions that don't include war. It seems like every problem that the U.S. faces where there's an international conflict is either going to war or the threat of using force. So we're not surprised at all. But what's really sad about it is if you look at an objective outcome that they claim, when I say they being the political leaders, claim that they want, which is to decrease terrorism, the State Department put out a report that says terrorism around the world has increased in 2013 by 43%. So you would think that if the most objective number of the outcome you're looking for has increased instead of decreased after 13 years of war, that other alternatives would be, you know, looked at. But no. So it's clear that war is the path that they always seek.
Michael, there are many people in the country who are talking about the existential threat that ISIL presents to the region and the world. They point to the group's deliberate tactic of slaughtering innocents, forced religious conversions, kidnapping and trafficking of women captives. They say that you really cannot use diplomacy or negotiations with such a murderous and brutal group, and that unfortunately military intervention here is the only conceivable way that you can rout this group from the territory they've captured.
Well, you know, I understand that. I mean, it's kind of like I've talked to people about the Klan here in the United States. I mean, you just couldn't go in and talk to the Klan and expect them to all of a sudden have respect for people of color and not believe in white supremacy. So certainly that makes sense. The question's not so much that. I think the question is, what role does the United States of America have in confronting ISIL? And in whatever role the United States government plays, it should not play a role that is going to strengthen ISIL and give people more reason to want to join ISIL, or if not join ISIL, to be an ally with ISIL, like the Sunni leadership is right now in Iraq. Because my understanding is that they don't necessarily believe in ISIL's ideology, but it's the dynamics of the politics internally in Iraq. So for us to think that bombing Sunnis and not helping that relationship that needs to be made better, that people not feel disenfranchised in Iraq. That's the key. And our continuing to put more weapons in there and to intervene on the side of the Shia and the Kurds is not going to be helpful to mending the fences that need to be mended between the Sunnis and the Shia in Iraq.
One issue I wanted to close off with is this. Do you believe President Obama should go to Congress to get authorization for what he's proposed in expanding this new war against ISIL? Some administration officials have come forward to say that the use of the 2002 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, known as AUMF, is all that they really need to commit U.S. forces in this new war against ISIS.
Well, of course, it's a double-edged sword in some way for us as peace activists, because then does it make it okay because we've gone to Congress and he's got the stamp of approval from Congress to go ahead and invade Syria, for example, or whatever the decisions are made. And I would say no, it wouldn't make it okay. However, of course, we want to curtail the president's ability to conduct military operations wherever he or she sees fit. So it is best, because Congress is supposed to be the body that declares war. And we seldom actually had Congress declare war, although we have done military operations on dozens. In fact, like 200 occasions, and I don't know if Congress maybe declared war five times or something of that nature. So, yes, we do want there to be a debate, and at least if there's a debate, it gives organizations like ours and people across the country who disagree with this the ability to contact their congressperson and be engaged in the debate, whereas if the president just has the power to do whatever he or she wants to, you know, there's no debate, and the president could take us into any war. So, yes, we do need the debate, and Congress needs to act.
That was Michael McPherson, Interim Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Find more perspectives on the escalating conflict in Iraq and Syria by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since March 1st, about 24 people have been walking across the country from Santa Monica, California to Washington, D.C., in what they're calling the Great March for Climate Action, or the Climate March. The action was the brainchild of former Iowa legislator Ed Fallon and took a full year of planning before marchers began their journey. The stated goal of the Great March is to change the hearts and minds of the American people, elected leaders, and people across the world to act now to address the climate crisis. The march seeks to build the broadest possible public consensus and is focused strictly on the climate crisis. Activists have been joined along the way by another dozen or so marchers at any given time, and as they walk, they've been speaking to local media, elected officials, and just regular people. They are due to arrive in the nation's capital on November 1st, just before the midterm election, and will carry out a week of actions there in an attempt to pressure Congress to take action on climate change. One of the marchers who's walking coast to coast is Lee Stewart. He's in his late 20s and first got involved in climate work in his home state of Virginia. He decided to dedicate 8 months of his life to the march, which covers up to 24 miles each day, before activists engage with local communities each night. Here in a conversation with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, Stewart describes how the in-person interactions he's experienced are very different than how the corporate media portrays public sentiment on climate issues. He also explains how the group decided to engage in direct action along the march route.
Walking across the country, you wouldn't, you know, it doesn't reflect what we see in the corporate media, because everyone's receptive of our message. Everyone knows that we need to act on the climate crisis. We have encountered very few climate deniers. And the real question that has been difficult and that has generated a lot of debate is what actions are necessary. And there, even on this march, among the marchers, there are different ideas about what the best path forward is. We try to be very open on the march and to promote a multifaceted, diverse approach, saying that we need everything. We need people working within the political system, pressuring government officials, elected officials, petitions and all of that. And then some people say we need more systemic change that's built from the ground up, where we really don't rely on the corrupt political system. We have that variety and that debate going on. I think as we go, we are understanding more and more that in order to face the climate crisis and face down the fossil fuel industry and the type of consumerism that leads to the climate crisis, we're going to have to take extraordinary action and stop business as usual. And that was a view held by a few people at the beginning of the march. And now it's a view that I would say the majority of the march holds. So we've long been talking about direct action, never really making any decisions. For the Chicago rally, we didn't want it to be a boring rally where people just speak and the crowd listens. So along the route, we planned to do two die-ins, just theatric sort of things at the Board of Trade in Chicago and at the Heartland Institute. And what we did is we went up to the building and declared it a climate crime scene. And a number of the people who were marching with us laid down on the sidewalk in front, and somebody gave a speech, and we were holding up signs explaining how the Heartland Institute's propagation of climate denial leads to a lot of suffering and will lead to even further suffering, and the same thing at the Board of Trade. So everyone loved that. We felt good about it, that we were doing a little bit more than just marching and talking. So the next day, we were in southeast Chicago, and the community groups there, two in particular, the Southeast Environmental Task Force and another group that was focused on banning pet coke, we were working with them, and they had a rally. In this community, there is a pet coke storage facility where these piles of sooty pet coke are sitting there, blowing into their communities. So what we were going to do was a small march through the streets of these communities, stop at one of the aldermen's offices and do a few speeches and chants, and then go to the storage facility, the KCBX pet coke storage facility, and have another die-in. And the energy was really amazing. We were happy to be there and meet everyone and learn about the front lines of the climate crisis. And we arrived at the storage facility, and there were gates, and then in front of the gates, there was a train track. And so we decided to do the die-in on the train track, and we all laid down, and someone started talking, and a train started to come. And this thing sort of emerged organically. Several people stood up and noticed the train was coming, and it was a single locomotive with nothing attached to it, and it started to slow down. So none of us felt any real danger that it wasn't going to stop. It was clearly slowing down. It was going to stop. The security people there were telling us to get off the tracks, but not very urgently. Some people got off the tracks and just stood right next to them, and the train stopped. It didn't want to pass us because it was in danger of hitting some of the people. So we were just chanting, "No more Petco, no more Petco," again and again, and got back on the tracks and sort of had a small demonstration there right in front of the train, which was blaring its horn at us. And apparently the community had never done an action like that before, and they were really energized by it. It was sort of like an icebreaker, because they're tired of pet coke making them sick, and they said to see that they can actually do something like stop a train like that gives them a direction forward and gives them the sense that they can plan something and resist what's going on there.
That was Lee Stewart, one of the members of the Great March for Climate Action. The Coast to Coast marchers will be participating in the September 21st People's Climate March in New York City before returning to pick up the march where they left off. Learn more about the Great March by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On the morning of May 15, 2013, Ken Ward, a veteran environmental organizer and Boston carpenter, and Jay O'Hara, a Quaker activist from Cape Cod, set out on a 32-foot lobster boat with the intention of blocking the path of a giant freighter that was on its way to deliver 40,000 tons of coal to the Brayton Point Power Plant in Somerset, Massachusetts. The small boat, which flew an American flag along with a banner which read, "Coal is stupid," was moved into position and then dropped a 200-pound anchor, preventing the 689-foot ship Energy Enterprise from offloading its cargo, one of the primary sources of climate change. The activists then called the local police to inform them of their civil disobedience action. Notified of the protest, the Coast Guard accompanied the freighter in two fast boats and then boarded and commandeered the lobster boat. The two activists then faced four criminal charges: conspiracy, disturbing the peace, failure to act to avoid a collision, and negligent operation of a motor vessel, which carries up to 2 years in jail. The pair had planned to employ what's called a necessity defense in court, calling a number of well-known environmental experts to testify on their behalf, including NASA climate scientist Jim Hansen and climate change activist and author Bill McKibben. But just as the trial was about to begin in the Fall River Courthouse on September 8th, Bristol County District Attorney Sam Sutter announced his decision to drop all criminal charges against the activists, reducing them to civil infractions and fines. His statement that he believed Ken and Jay were acting to reduce harm to the planet amazed the activists, their supporters, and the assembled media. Your reporter spoke with one of the activists, Jay O'Hara, who talks about why he felt moved by the climate crisis to risk arrest and imprisonment in his act of civil disobedience, and the circumstances which led the prosecutor to drop all criminal charges and announce that he would be participating in the historic September 21st People's Climate March in New York City.
On May 15th, 2013, Ken and I, on our little white lobster boat named the Henry David T, anchored in the ship channel at the Brayton Point Power Station, which is in southeastern Massachusetts in the town of Somerset, and is the single largest source of emissions, climate change and carbon emissions in New England. And we were there for most of the day, where we blocked a huge hulking black ship, the Energy Enterprise, from being able to unload its shipment of Appalachian mountaintop removal coal for the day.
What led you to risk your freedom for the cause of confronting climate change by engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience?
Well, I think I would actually characterize what we did as not just civil disobedience, but direct action, which is that we put our bodies in between the harm that's being done. We put our bodies in between the coal that was coming in on the ship and the plant that was hungrily ready to burn it. I think what got me to that point of being willing to do that was that no one else seemed to be sticking their necks out. Our politicians haven't been sticking their necks out. Even the people who say they agree with us and are supposedly climate champions in Congress and supposed climate champions in Massachusetts, none of whom have responded with the sort of urgency and resolve that the scientists tell us this challenge needs to be addressed with.
Now, there was an interesting development when you went to court to face these charges. The prosecutor in the case took a surprising stand. From what I understand, District Attorney Sam Sutter wiped away these charges, dropped the charges, for a very interesting and compelling reason. You want to explain?
It was kind of a miraculous thing, and I think is the sort of thing that happens when we take great risks ourselves and we put our money where our mouths are, is that other people find it in their hearts to respond in kind. And what ended up happening was that District Attorney Sam Sutter came into the courtroom and started conversations with our lawyers, which resulted in the conspiracy charge being dropped completely and the other remaining three charges being reduced to civil infractions, essentially nothing more than you would get if you were getting a speeding ticket. Instead of fines, we were held responsible, essentially. That was the legal finding, is that we were found responsible, which I'm pretty happy to say that I was responsible for that. We are hoping that more people will find it in their hearts to be responsible for dealing with climate change. We paid restitution to the town of Somerset for their police overtime and the state police as well. So all that, we kind of had some hints that the charges were going to be reduced, but the real miracle part of it was that about 10 minutes or so after we had come out of the courthouse and made a statement, the district attorney came outside and spoke to the press. And not only did he say he was dropping the charges, he expounded upon how critical this issue was, how much he personally and the entire district attorney's office cared about this issue, and said that in the face, essentially in the face of political leadership on this issue, it was necessary for citizens to start taking things into their own hands, which was pretty surprising and kind of a wonderful capstone to the experience. I think when we put our hearts out there and live in accordance with the truth that we know, other people are moved to do the same, and I think that's what happened with District Attorney Sutter.
Now, I've heard that this prosecutor, District Attorney Sam Sutter, has plans to go to the New York City People's Climate March on September 21st. Do you think you'll be joining him in the march, which would be quite a spectacle, you both marching together arm in arm down the streets in New York?
Yeah, we're still trying to exactly figure out the logistics of how we meet in this enormous throng that's expected down in New York, but we're both, I think, looking forward to being there.
Do you have a sense, experiencing what you did in the courthouse in Massachusetts, a state official, obviously, in sync with your concern about climate change, do you have a sense that there is a bold and popular movement about to be born that can change policy?
You know, we're getting there. I think we're getting there. When we took our action in May, we were just two guys and some supporters on the beach. A few months later, in July, there were over 350 people who were rallying at the gates of the plant, with four dozen people risking arrest to make the point that that plant needed to be shut immediately. When we step up and take the sort of risk that we did, others who maybe aren't ready to take that much risk are ready to follow when they see the moral stakes. And so I'm pretty hopeful that more and more people are going to start taking these sorts of actions, and that more and more people are going to essentially come in behind and support them and drive the point home.
That was Massachusetts climate activist Jay O'Hara. Learn more about O'Hara and Ken Ward's direct action protest at the Brayton Point Power Plant in Massachusetts and other campaigns to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.